Good to be with you guys here this morning. I am continuing with our Fruitful Church series, and I'm excited about the series. I think the timing's good, because I think we've got to kind of take a step back and often just ask ourselves the question, you know, do you want our church to be fruitful? Or even a companion question is, do you want to be fruitful in your life? Very few people would answer no to either of those questions, right? It's kind of a softball. But actually, I kind of get hung up sometimes on the word fruitful. Like, do people really use this word? Like, if I'm asking how your business is going, do I go, hey, how's your business? Is it fruitful? Gotta be like, yeah, I guess. And so actually, in some ways, I feel like we're a bit disconnected from this good Bible word. I mean, actually, the best way to ask a question like that is, how's your business? Are you getting results? Yeah, I'm getting results. I mean, we've been investing and spending time and money and energy, and I'm getting results. Are you having success? Yes, I'm having success in my business or in whatever endeavor that it is. And so I just want to draw a connection for us, because that's what fruitfulness is, results. There's a cause and effect. And the Bible describes this, is that there are causes to these effects that are desirable, fruitfulness. And that's why I'm loving this series, because it's all about the thing that I think all of us want. We want results. We want success. We want fruitfulness. And I think the difficult thing is that being fruitful is not always easy, right? I mean, it's something that we all want, but the truth of the matter is it often takes longer than we originally thought, right? It takes more work than we originally thought. The results are not always what we hoped for, and the process is not always what we expect. And so often in our attempt to be fruitful, to be successful, to get results, we actually are disappointed, and it seems to cause more heartache than joy. Have you had that experience? You have an idea of the success you want to have, and then all of a sudden, all of these other things either happen or don't to make it so that it's not happening for you. And so the problem is, we want to be fruitful, but sometimes we must understand, you know, what that is, what that looks like, how it happens. And so when it doesn't look like what we expect, we become discouraged. We become disillusioned. And in fact, we actually kind of start to withdraw, ironically, in danger of becoming fruitless. And so that's why this Fruitful Church series for me is so important, because it actually speaks both of the church and our fruitfulness, but also the fruitfulness of our individual lives. And these things are vitally connected. I think some of us actually think, well, the church is one thing and I'm one thing, but no, we're members of the body of Christ. So we talk about the fruitful church, we're talking about us. So pay close attention, because if any of these things I've described, whether the desire to be fruitfulness or actually the gap that exists between you and fruitfulness sometimes, if any of those things are true, then we've just got to be paying close attention. We're going through the chapter Isaiah 54, which is just a picture of how God brings results in his people, how fruitfulness begins to happen. And so I just want to read the first three verses again. Alan read them last week, but we're going to do a real close study on this, because there's tons that we can gain and gather from this passage. In verse 1, it says, "Sing, O barren one who did not bear. Break forth into singing and cry aloud, you who have not been in labor. For the children of the desolate one will be more than the children of her who is married, says the Lord. Enlarge the place of your tent." Let's just pause here. This is the key part for us this morning. Very famous verse. "Enlarge the place of your tent. Let the curtains of your habitations be stretched out. Do not hold back. Lengthen your cords and strengthen your stakes, for you will spread abroad to the right and to the left, and your offspring will possess the nations and will people the desolate cities." Why is this passage important for us and our church right now? I mean, are we barren? Is that why we need to dig into this? I think actually we've got to just find our story in the story of Israel. We looked at this and we just went, well, where are we? We're not barren. We've actually been quite fruitful as of late. And so the cool thing about this is I feel like we're kind of in the next chapter right after these verses. I think God's actually done some enlarging of our tent. I think God's actually done some stretching. I think we've actually begun to inhabit some desolate places. And that's why it's so helpful for us, because we can see exactly how God works in all of this. There was a time, as Matt mentioned, that we actually were planting all of these churches. And then for about 5 years, I would say, Southlands kind of went a bit barren. Financially, we were really thin. We weren't multiplying. And I think God was doing something in us. I think even at that time, he may have said these exact words to us. And now we're in the next chapter. It's important as we read the Bible to just find ourselves in the story, both as a church and individually. And so I want to now kind of take a look at what is it saying? What did God say he was going to do that I think we're actually walking in right now? And what does that mean for us? How do we live that out? I mean, the first thing we see, right, in verse 2 right there, he says, enlarge the place of your tent and let the curtains of your habitations be stretched out. So the first thing that happens as he begins to bring fruitfulness and growth and as he begins to expand us is enlargement, right? It makes sense. And it's interesting because I think one of the things that I just enjoyed learning about this is, you know, what's happening right now in Isaiah is that the Israelites have been brought into exile in Babylon. They were basically being punished because they had walked away from God. And for 70 years, they were in Babylon. They were in a kind of exile that meant that they had to leave their cities. And now God is sending them back into their cities. And so imagine having to leave your home and go live under somebody else's roof, as it were. And now he's saying, I'm going to send you back into those cities. I'm going to enlarge you again. And one commentator says, she, Israel, is challenged to expand on all sides to make room for her enlarged family. Growth will continue as her descendants move out into the villages and towns. When Judah's population went into exile, leaving many of these villages and towns abandoned, the vacuum was filled by squatters from neighboring areas. So he's actually saying, you're going to go back into these towns and you're going to take over. You're going to enlarge again. You've shrunk down into exile in Babylon, but now you're going to enlarge again. Why is it important? I mean, do we care about enlargement? I mean, I think we do. I think many of us want to be enlarged. Many of us envision a future that's larger than where we are right now, right? Do you envision things for your life that's just kind of bigger than they are right now? I mean, many of us are kind of daunted by enlargement, right? But most of us are interested in enlargement. If I came up to any of you and I said, I think God is enlarging you, you would be like, whoa, what does that mean? I wonder what areas. And then you might even start to think, maybe it's in this area. God is enlarging you. Ooh, that's exciting. I mean, it's a Bible thing. Throughout the Bible, God is telling his people, I'm going to enlarge you. Exodus 34, he says, for I will cast out nations before you and enlarge your borders. Deuteronomy 12:20 says, when the Lord your God enlarges your territory as he has promised you. And then it goes on. And then probably the most famous one that many of us know, 1 Chronicles 4:10. This one's called the Prayer of Jabez. Many of us know this one. The book came out in the year 2000. Jabez called upon the God of Israel, saying, oh, that you would bless me and enlarge my border, and that your hand might be with me, and that you would keep me from harm so that it might not bring me pain. And God granted what he asked. That's so appealing. I mean, it's so appealing that that book actually was only one of four Christian books ever in history to sell over 10 million copies. It actually was the fastest selling book in the history of publishing in the first year. It sold 2 million copies. I mean, it's unbelievable. And I think it's because this idea of enlargement is very tantalizing to us. It's appealing to us. And you know, it's funny because in the Old Testament, enlargement was all about land. And this is where we have to shift our focus. I don't think, if I came to you and I said, Shelley, God is enlarging you, you don't think that you're going to get an acre now where you've had, you know, a third. We don't think it has to do with land. It's more abstract than that. But the Old Testament, that's what it was. In the New Testament, it's actually people. It's about people. In 2 Corinthians 10:15, Paul says, "But our hope is that your faith increases. Our area of influence among you may be greatly enlarged so that we may preach the gospel in lands beyond you." And I think in our fruitful church process that we're going through right now, we're being enlarged. But is anybody a little uncomfortable right now with some of this enlargement that's happening? Some of this stretching that's happening? I mean, it's actually difficult. It's not comfortable. It's not natural sometimes. It doesn't feel like. I think oftentimes we feel the pain of this stretching is wrong. No, this is not right. Something is wrong. God, why are you doing this to me? And yet, it would stand to reason that in enlargement, it is going to be uncomfortable. And God's actually going to do something that will make us bigger than we were. He's got a bigger future in mind. But it's going to actually cause a bit of strain along the way. I got an email this last week about a woman that I prayed for, and interestingly, it was about becoming pregnant, and she was always afraid to become pregnant, and I just prayed a simple prayer, nothing too profound, at least I didn't think so, and she emailed me this week, and she said, I got to let you know I'm pregnant. She said this, she said, I knew I needed prayer because as a wife and a woman, I've always struggled with the idea of having kids. It was never that I don't want them, but I was more nervous of growing up and making mistakes and have them possibly following in the wrong footsteps. I think I was more afraid of what society offers rather than what God offers. And I mean, how many of us feel that? Now, in the case of her, there will be an actual physical enlargement. I'm going to tread carefully here. But there's also a stretching of mindset. There's a stretching of faith. She needed to gain a revelation that actually God and his intent and his power and his plan for this child was more powerful than the society that was trying to break in and influence him or her for bad. She had to actually step into that frame of mind. Amazingly, prayer just met her in a powerful way, and God just shifted something in her. And we do need this often. When we're being stretched, we go, I don't know if I can or want to or have the capacity or ability. And actually, we need to be empowered by the Holy Spirit through this process of being stretched. But oftentimes, we're kind of just, you know, white-knuckling through the stretching without really leaning on God to get us through this time, even though at the end of the day, we'd admit that we want it. We shrink back from it for a whole multitude of reasons. And I think part of what I want to do in this first point is just say enlargement is good. And theoretically, we all want it, but practically, if you're struggling with it, it's okay. It's just that don't shrink back from it, because actually, at the end of the day, we will ultimately then really just thwart what God is wanting to do, or at minimum will prolong and frustrate his plan. Wonderfully, he is sovereign. He will continue this process, but do we want to do it with a sense of joy or a sense of pain? Enlargement requires stretching, and stretching is uncomfortable. Stretching requires flexibility, and if you try to stretch something too rigid, it just breaks. Do you envision a bigger future than your present circumstance? If not, begin to. Enlargement is good. If you do, understand it will require stretching by definition. Are you struggling right now? Is it because of God's stretching? This woman was stretched to find new faith and lean on a new idea. So I think that's one encouragement to our church as we start to look at God producing through us, God enlarging us, God doing things that we've actually been praying for him to do. We can just count on a little bit of stretching going on. What does it say in the second one? In the second part of this verse, it says, do not hold back, lengthen your cords and strengthen your stakes. So when God is expanding his people, and that's who we are. We're finding our story as God's people in the Israelite story as God's people. When he's doing this, He's also asking for strengthening of our stakes. And what does that mean? I mean, what is he speaking of there? You know, interestingly, when a people was inhabited by the people of God, or when a city was inhabited by the people of God, the Jews, it meant that the culture would bear their culture, right? The culture of that city was the culture of the Jews. And so whatever it was that they did, their practices, their mindset, their values, their habits, their traditions, all of those things was actually determined by the people who lived there. And so when they left, actually other cultures took over. And so God's saying, actually, strengthen your stakes because I'm enlarging you, and I want you to actually influence the culture by your values. Really, the strengthening of stakes has everything to do with our values. Those things that make you who you are and pin you into the ground, make sure those things are strong, because that is the thing that will hold the entire tent together. And if you think about, as he goes on and talks about desolate cities, you know, a desolate city, by this definition, would be those cities where God's people didn't dwell. And so he was going to send them in there. But at that time, you know, the culture of those cities was not the culture of his people. It wasn't the culture of heaven. That wasn't the primary culture. And, you know, what's interesting about this, and because I run the Alpha course, you know, where we have people who don't believe, they don't know what they think, and they come in, and one of the biggest questions that I get is, like, why does God have the Jews kill everybody? Because that happens when, in the Old Testament, when the people of God are going to move into a city, they basically just slaughter everyone who's there. And this is a very difficult thing. I, a lot of Christians don't like to talk about this, especially with non-believers, because it's like, what do you do? What do you do with that? Well, I know it seems like he's kind of mean, but trust me, he's not. Just when he killed those, like, 150,000 people, it's hard to sort of come to grips with. Well, the good news is he's not asking us to do that when it comes to inhabiting desolate cities, right? But I got to say this, and I know this is a bit of a pithy remark, but I'm a preacher. What do you want? The New Testament does instruct us to kill. But not people. Not people. Actually, in Colossians 3:5, it says this: put to death, therefore, what is earthly in you. Sexual immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry. Picks up in verse 8, but now you must put them all away: anger, wrath, malice, slander, and obscene talk from your mouth. Do not lie to one another, seeing that you have put off the old self with its practices and put on the new self, which is being renewed in knowledge after the image of its creator. See, Jesus, who came in the same spirit that God commanded his people to kill the inhabitants of the land, Jesus came with a different plan. He came not to kill people, but to kill sin and death. And so that's why Paul in Colossians here is urging them, put to death all of these things that are actually creating havoc in your lives and the lives of other people. So in one sense, it hasn't changed. He's still asking us to put these things to death. And I think that we've just got to sort of stand back and take a sober look at that, because it's violent. But it's violent on sin. It's violent against these things. And really, that's at the end of the day what he's talking about when it comes to strengthening our stakes. Because our values, we have a lot of values here at Southlands. If you haven't gone to our Coming to Community or Committing to Community, well, you'll crack open our DNA booklet, and we believe in things like being devoted to prayer, building authentic relationships, pursuing diversity, passionate worship. These are all values of ours. And those things are good. But actually, what are our values? Those are some good values. But I mean, is our greatest value and distinctive, like, who makes us who we are? Is it that we get together and have potlucks? I mean, kind of, but lots of people do that. Is it that we're financially generous? We are. I think we're on track to raise $400,000 for the Jubilee campaign and basically just give it away. Yeah. I mean, that's amazing. Other people have given more money. Sorry. They have. There's other people that are generous too. What are our distinctives? What make us great? Is it that we have strong beliefs? Lots of people have strong beliefs. What makes us different? What makes us different? No, really, what makes us different? It's that we're holy. That's what makes us different. Because by the biblical definition of holiness, as it's defined by what Jesus did on the cross to renew who we are, nobody else is doing that. Nobody else is holy. God said to his people in Leviticus 20:26, and then Peter repeats it in 1 Peter. God says this, "Be holy because I am holy." We've got a corner on the market with holiness. Nobody else is holy as the Bible defines and describes it. I mean, in some ways, I see a few of you kind of scratching your head. Is that right? No, it is. I mean, that is what is unique and distinct. That was always what was unique and distinct about the Israelites. They worshiped the one God who was holy. Nobody else was holy. No other God was holy. He was the only one that was holy. And I mean, my growing concern is that holiness is kind of out of style. Authenticity is in, holiness is out. But actually, the Bible calls us to be authentically holy. And so we're kind of left with a bit of a problem because I think oftentimes we've sort of said, hey, look, I'm not, you know, super heavy-handed into moralism, all that stuff. Neither was Jesus, but he was holy. He was so holy. I mean, when people beheld this man, they were like, who is this guy? And actually, they were referring to his holiness. He was integrated with the life of God in ways that no one else had previously demonstrated. And those things manifested themselves in a variety of ways. But he was captivating because he was holy. And I think there's sort of this fear that we're going to be holier than thou. Well, what does that mean? Well, that means that we actually now, by some superiority, look down on other people because we're better than they are. We're more pure. We're more moral than they are. But actually, God's saying, by the way, you could have none of that holiness without the price I paid with my son, Jesus Christ. But insofar as I paid that price, be holy. I've given you the means to holiness. I've given you the means to look different than everybody else so that you could reflect me and connect them to me. And it's just so funny because I think often, you know, we're like, hey, man, you know, I'm just like you. You know, I drink too much every now and again, and, you know, I look at porn, or, you know, I know I use words I shouldn't always use, but, you know, that's just me coming out. That's just me. And I think the problem we don't realize is people are like, well, then, if you're just like me and I'm just like you, what needs to change? Rather than testimony of, you know, I actually don't drink like I used to. I used to abuse alcohol. I used to abuse relationships with women. I used to swear up at me personally. I'm a communicator. I leveraged every word and made many up. I was so creative with cussing and cursing and swearing. It just brought me great joy to do that. I mean, it was a hobby, I would say. And I say, you know what, now I don't do any of that. Not because I'm better than anybody else, but he came and he did something and he redeemed my speech. And I say, like some of the guys I knew when I was in high school and college, they're like, so what do you do now? I'm like, I'm a preacher. And they're like, you? You're talking about the Bible with that mouth? Yeah, God did something so profound in me that honestly it's inexplicable outside of the death of Jesus on the cross. I am holy now, holier than I was, that's for sure, and on my way to becoming holier. I want to reflect his glory in such a powerful way that people are like, have you met that guy? There's something about him. So when he tells us to strengthen our stakes, that he's enlarging us, but we've got to make sure that we pin down pretty hard. I mean, you know that a small tent requires small stakes. If you have those little pup tents, they give you the toothpicks, right, to drive the thing into the ground. Have you ever seen the stakes of a circus tent? I mean, they're like this big and it requires a sledgehammer to put them in. If he's really enlarging us, we need the sledgehammer stakes. We need values that go deep. If we've got very little kingdom ambition, then we actually don't need much holiness. But actually, if what we want to do is take the earth over for the sake of Jesus, if we want to actually people the desolate cities, we actually need holiness. And there's other kind of reaction that says, well, I can't make myself holy. That's true, but why is Paul saying, put to death these things that are happening? Put them to death. You put them to death. You put them to death. Because actually, God has made a way for you to do as such. And so don't get lazy about it. Actually, pursue it with all of your heart and mind. Because it's those values, those stakes that drive down deeply. And all the other values are good. But for me, this is arguably the most important one, is that we were so inextricably one with him that we reflect his glory in such a way that the fruit of our lives demonstrates that we are not like anybody else on the face of the planet, that actually people come to know him. I think what's amazing in this opportunity that we have is that the biggest problem the world faces is sin and death and a potential future of being eternally separated from the one living thing in the whole universe, which is God. Our holiness is a signpost. Jesus' holiness and the things he did that were different than anyone else who had come before him or who came after actually was a signpost. And he was standing there saying, look at me. And as little versions of this man who was God, we are supposed to be doing the same exact thing. But I think many of us know we're in no kind of shape to. But it's nothing to be ashamed of if we continue to point to the ongoing work of God redeeming and restoring our lives. Because every one of us can point to the work of God. My concern with this authenticity movement, I'll call it, is that it actually completely negates the things that God has done in many of us. Talk about your struggles. Wonderful. Do you make more of those than what God has done in your life to actually create holiness? Stop. And actually say, he is making me holier and holier every day. And it is such a profound experience. The last thing, after enlargement, strengthening, is dwelling. What does it look like now to be in this enlarged place with these strong stakes? What does it look like to live that way? Last year, or last week, Alan said this, you know, oftentimes in the case where we've spread all of these people out, we feel scattered, we feel thinner, there's fewer folks around. We send people to Whittier and Fullerton and Thailand, and they're going all over the place. So what we do is we tend to huddle in together. And actually, that's not the dwelling that he has in mind. He's saying something else. He says, for you will spread abroad to the right and to the left, and your offspring will possess the nations and will people the desolate cities. Do you know God's original intent was that the entire earth would be occupied by people that worship him? That was his original intent. I am so stoked that we are sending two of my very good friends, among others, to Chiang Rai, Thailand. You know, 93% of the population is Buddhist. 6% is Islamic, and 1%, less than 1% is Christian. That is a desolate city by any stretch of the means. And the beauty of it is they're not going to go in and wipe out the people. They're going to wipe out what's happening in their own lives that doesn't glorify him. And as they do so, the holiness of the Lord will actually reflect his glory. And people around him are going, who are these people who have just moved to this place? They have something that is profound. It's easy for us to see that in Chiang Rai, Thailand, but you know, Fullerton and Whittier, there is desolation. I mean, I don't know if you realize this. I mean, we look at Orange County and it's like, it's so Christian, right? I mean, there's like just a lot of churches. And I came from Connecticut where there's like no churches anywhere. And I came here and I'm like, oh, everybody's Christian. You know, half of the people in Orange County actually are unaffiliated, not don't associate themselves with any religion at all. Half. That's desolation. If God intended for every single person that inhabited the earth to worship him, that is a certain desolation. LA County is the same exact way. So we've put another location in Fullerton. We've put another location in Whittier. He has enlarged our territory so that we have been able to people the desolate cities. As we've mentioned, there's another church in San Bernardino County. You know what San Bernardino's stat is? 60% are unaffiliated. It's desolate. It's desolate. And God's saying, I'm enlarging you. Can you bear with it? Can you see the purpose in it? Can you get excited about it, even though it's stretching? Even though I'm challenging you to become something bigger, not just as a church, but individually. I'm calling you. Put to death these things so that actually you reflect my glory. You know, I think one of the biggest struggles we have is that we have an idea of fruitfulness. We want to be fruitful, whether it's in one area of our lives or another, whether we look at it from a church and we want to expand and enlarge our territory so that we may be an influence in these desolate cities. But what happens is we have a sense of how it should go, right? I remember when we arrived in Southern California 10 years ago, I was all ready for fruitfulness, you know? I was ready for success. Because you never, like, launch into something ready for nothing to happen, ready to fail. Like, I'm excited we're going to jump in and just fail miserably. So I was like, I felt like I was loaded in a cannon, and I was just like, okay, Lord, shoot me out. Like, this is it. I'm going for it. And have you ever had that experience, and then all of a sudden you just hear sort of a pop and a fizzle, and you just sort of roll out the end of the cannon onto the ground? Is that often more of the way that it happens? All right, I'm ready. For the first 5 years, we saw everything that we had basically dwindle down to nothing. It's like, Lord, this isn't the fruitfulness that I was planning. These aren't the results that I was hoping for. And I just missed the cycle I was in. He's like, no, it's okay. I'm just preparing the soil for fruitfulness. You thought you were going to be fruitful, but I couldn't even plant in the soil, not for the kind of seed that I want to grow. And I just began to realize, oh my gosh, I missed the cycle. I mean, imagine a farmer who goes out and he's got a full crop and he just tills it all over because he missed the season. No, you're supposed to harvest what was there. Oh, crud. Or he goes out and he looks at the barren dirt and he only planted seeds yesterday and he's like, where is the fruit? I mean, he would just be a fool. But I think we often miss the seasons and cycles of fruitfulness. And we've got to discern where we're at. And so by impatience or disappointment, we don't know where we are in that cycle. And I missed it. I spent 5 years sort of cultivating fresh soil in me, planting fresh seed in me. And I feel like I've been bearing some fruit now 10 years after I was expecting to. Whew. I feel like I want to stop there. But you've had this experience, haven't you? It's hard. And we need help. But I think one of the hardest things is that when we don't see the kind of fruit that we want, we have a temptation to just replant. And you know, actually, that's almost never a recipe for success. My wife had a big cucumber plant in the garden, and she's like, oh, it's getting too big. I'll move it over here into a pot. And it just died. No reflection on her gardening, by the way. 24 hours, it was just like brown and dead. And that was just because of an inconvenience we had with our garden. But often we don't see fruit. We just want to like uproot the whole dang thing and stick it somewhere else, which is actually moving in the wrong direction. It's by patient cultivation and actually just watering and just day by day availing ourselves of the work of God in bearing fruit that it actually comes about. It was interesting. The last house we owned, we had two massive orange trees on the property. And Minnesota boy, like, everything freezes to tundra level every 6 months. So fruit trees are not a thing. I mean, we have apple trees, but that's about it. And so when we were moving in, somebody went and they took one of the oranges off the tree. And they were like, oh, I just had one of the oranges on your tree. It's incredible. And I was like, well, aren't they all good? And, you know, California, no. Not all. Actually, most oranges aren't that great that you just get off somebody's tree. And I was like, oh, really? And then I began to learn a little bit about this, and it's actually older, mature trees that produce really sweet fruit. It's so interesting. And then I learned some other things, that you actually have to pick the fruit. You know, I'm just thinking, well, it's there if I want it. No, actually, it will rot. It will fall off the tree. You will get rodents and bugs. And I'm like, oh, this thing of having a fruit tree is actually a pain in the butt. I like the oranges, but it's a lot of work. And you just realize, actually, life is the same way. It's like we want the fruit, we like the oranges, but it's a lot of work. And we've got to know how it works. And so I actually began to get very good at understanding, okay, this is the season where we're going to get them, and this is where I got to pick them. Otherwise, I'm not going to get more. That was the other interesting thing. It's like if you don't harvest the tree, it actually doesn't grow as much the next time around. It's like, wow. Again, Minnesota boy. We farm, but not where I lived. It was just, you know, normal city life. And so that was helpful to me. It's a helpful reflection. Now, we live in a house on the corner of our neighborhood. And it's interesting because I think this is where we get into what God wants to do by doing all of what he's doing, by enlarging us and by strengthening our stakes. What is he trying to do? Well, he wants us to go and inhabit these places. He wants us to dwell in these places, and he wants us to connect to the people that he loves, much in the pattern of Jesus, who came to dwell with us. We live in a corner lot, which I didn't want because it's kind of like exposed, you know? There's less privacy in a corner lot. So like we have a kitchen window over the sink, and if I'm like out there with no shirt on and you can only see me like here, it looks like I'm naked at my sink. I've never done that, just so you know. But it's exposed. I mean, it's like it's out there for all the world to see. When you drive into my neighborhood, if I'm standing there with no shirt on at the sink, you will see me at the right time of day. And we've got a big picture window in our dining room. And I was walking over to my house from my neighbor the other day, and I'm looking and I'm like, man, my house is like everybody can see in. It's crazy. But actually, it's just such a picture. It's a picture of how God wants us to dwell. It's why he's enlarging us. It's why he's strengthening our stakes. He wants us to actually be completely transparent, to show him something, to show people something beautiful, to actually display the splendor of glory and glory of God in our holiness. Nobody else is doing that. That's something we have uniquely. Because actually, if through my picture window they saw my kids fighting and me screaming at my wife, that's not worth sharing with the rest of the world for the sake of Jesus. So actually, it's caused me to go, wow, you know, I can't do anything like really weird here. Otherwise, people are going to see. And so it's not just for appearances. It makes me go, Lord, won't you let this house be a light into this neighborhood? After I moved in, I learned that actually the contractor who built our whole neighborhood lived in this house. This was his house. He built it for himself. And I was like, that's so cool, because you would have known that he would have wanted this to be a model for the rest of the neighborhood. It's right on the corner, so that when people drive in, they go, oh, wow, this neighborhood's got nice houses in it. That's just the way he would have done it. I'm so grateful for this home, but it's actually more of a picture than anything else. This is the way he wanted us to live, on the corner, with the shades open. Actually, as a beacon, I trim my lawn, I trim my trees, I landscape, partially just to bless people who are driving into the neighborhood, to make our neighborhood look great. It's a wonderful opportunity. Look, it takes a little more work, but I feel like I'm not just representing me or my house or even the neighborhood. I'm representing something bigger, as are we all. And Jesus knew that when he came. He's like, I want you to see me. Look at me. Look at me. Because actually, if you've seen me, you see the Father. We have opportunities to reflect his glory in similar ways. But oftentimes, we're kind of shuttering the windows out of shame, out of fear, out of complacency, out of laziness. And God's just saying, no, just open them and come to me. Trust me. I'm doing something in you that I want to show everybody else. That's how I want you to dwell. Just like that, look, it may be a stretch, but my corner house is not unlike Jesus, the cornerstone. It's actually just a little bit of a pillar. We're each supposed to be little pillars, little cornerstones in our neighborhood. That's what he's calling us to. That's the opportunity. That's the privilege. That's the responsibility. And so rather than say, hey, look, I'm just like you. I mean, look, I'm all jacked up. We do have our struggles. We do. We can relate to people who have been through difficult issues, who have sinned, who have struggled. And yet we've got a different story. We've moved on beyond that because God has done a redemptive work. He's worked in us so that we can share that with others. So in the end of the day, I think we've got to discern the cycles of fruitfulness. What is happening when? So that we know, hey, I'm in the sowing phase. I'm in the growing phase. I'm in the giving phase. There's just something about having to pick the fruit on the tree so that you can grow more that's so powerful. Are we giving? Are we giving? We've been giving, right? This church has been giving. I'm so glad to celebrate that we are a fruitful church. We've been giving and giving. And now we're sowing again, and we're growing again, and we're going to give again because we love this cycle of God's fruitfulness. That's where we're at as a church. Where are you in your life? What's God doing in this season that you may need just a little bit of help seeing or bearing through, because it's not always easy, these cycles and these seasons. But we've got to apply ourselves to the current season, the current cycle, and just know that it will change, but that God's actually doing these things to enlarge who it is that we are. Let's pray.